Good morning. You're listening to Community Radio KGNU Boulder Denver. This morning on A Public Affair, we have another in our quarterly series on end-of-life issues, practically dying. And I'd like to welcome my co-host for this series, Kim Mooney, to the studio. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning, May.
This morning, we're taking a look at hope. Why hope, and what aspects of hope will we be discussing?
Well, you know, we talked about discussing hope at the end of life, but truly when you look at life as a long, complex journey, we start learning how to hope or not to hope early in life. But why it's important to us is because instead of seeing life as this long journey, we often at the end of life see people being dropped off a cliff and being told there is no more hope. You know, the damning sentence in our profession really is there's nothing more we can do. And we know that that's not true, but it's a real important thing to be able to reframe it and help people develop the capacity for hope.
And when you say your profession, I'd like to remind listeners, Kim Mooney worked for many, many years in hospice care. She's now also continuing her work in end-of-life issues and working around particularly educating people on end-of-life issues. Mm-hmm. Well, we have two guests today to discuss this. Jamie Beachy is Manager for Spiritual Care and Education at Boulder Community Health. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we have a returning guest this morning. Delighted to welcome back Marcia Latanzi-Licht, who is co-founder of Boulder County Hospice, now True Community Care. And she's now a psychotherapist, an educator and an author. Good to have you back.
Nice to see you again, Maeve.
So I'll ask both of you first. Marcia, what do you think of when you think of hope when it comes to end of life? And we'll get into your own personal background on this, because I think when we're talking about hope, it's not just for the person who's facing the end of their life. It's also for the families who are also around people who are dying. So, Marcia.
Absolutely. I think one of the most important things about hope is that it's an element that sustains us through the most dark or difficult times of our lives. And Kim was exactly right. Hope changes across our life. I think the term I often use is it kaleidoscopes, that we may, if we're diagnosed with an illness, hope for a cure, and then we may hope for treatment success, and then we may hope for good time, and then we may hope for specific kinds of times with our loved ones. So throughout our lifetime, you're absolutely right, Kim, hope looks different and seems different, but it is one of the threads through our life that can keep us going and give us a sense of control over our own well-being and over maybe some of the conditions or circumstances of our lives. Obviously, control is somewhat of an illusion, but there are things we can do. And I think hope is always associated with how we make choices, how we choose to see things. I often use the image, which window do you choose to look out of? Do you choose to look out of this window where it might be dark and shaded, or do you choose to look out another window where there might be some light and some different possibilities? So that's another element, the element of possibilities.
Now, like Kim, you have a very long background in hospice care as the founder of Boulder County Community
Co-founder.
Hospice. Co-founder. Now True Community Care. Now, take us back to why you first initially got involved in hospice care, because that also ties in very much with this idea of hope.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, hospice was just beginning in this country in the 70s, and the hospice here that is now True was one of the first dozen or so in this country. And it was out of a movement, if it's the 70s, out of a sense that we could do better and that there were needs that people had that were not being addressed properly. There was a tremendous amount of avoidance. Research told us that people who are dying were not responded to, dealt with. And so it was a sense, and it was about hope. Cicely Saunders, the grandmother of hospice from England, used to always say, "You matter because you are you." So there was some hope embedded in that we would not abandon people, that we would pay attention to them, that we would address their needs, because managing people's pain and symptoms, paying attention to them, having them feel like they are, like they have resources and support available to them, gives them hope. Not hope specifically for a cure, but hope that they will be sustained and loved through this time. So that, I think, is what makes the difference, and that is what hospice is embodying, hopefully, for families and people still today.
With Jamie Beachy, you're the manager for spiritual care and education at Boulder Community Health. When you think of hope when it comes to end of life, what are your thoughts?
Well, I can definitely appreciate everything that's been said up to this point, that hospice is such an important movement in palliative care, and the hospital is a an attempt to create a similarly supportive environment while people are still making decisions about their treatment and thinking about their goals for care and what will bring them, you know, the greatest sense of meaning and as they move into the future with a difficult diagnosis. From my role as a chaplain over the years and coming out of a spiritual care tradition, I'm aware that, you know, that many of the spiritual care or spiritual and religious traditions emphasize that hope is really not necessarily a turning away from death and a way of avoiding suffering, but that hope can be actually a process of facing death and seeing everything in your life come into focus through through the experience of anticipating loss. And so facing death, and as we all will inevitably be in that place of facing the end of our lives, and we, of course, don't know when that time will come, but people that have a sense of moving closer to death often experience a real focus in terms of gratitude. What, you know, they're much more aware of what is meaningful to them in their lives. Their relationships sometimes become more, you know, all of the conflicts and the petty struggles that we face with our families often kind of fall to the side, and we recognize that, you know, the love and the support, which is so much at the heart of what life is about, becomes more clear, and we can move toward reconciliation. And not that this always happens when people face death, but it is really an opportunity to embrace life more fully and experience gratitude and appreciation for this precious life that we have. And so most of the traditions recognize that contemplating death and facing death is actually a gift, and that there's hope in living more deeply into life, and that if we can all do that sooner, the wiser we are, you know, and the better we are for it. So
now, in many ways, that's an end of life. That's a best case scenario where we have the time to be reflective, and we have time being the key. Of course, many end of life situations are horrific. Children, young people, accidents, violence. That's so right. How do you have hope when you're dealing with something like that?
Well, that's a good question. And a lot of the care that we provide at the hospital also is in the context of trauma, you know, sudden trauma where death comes unexpectedly and people don't have this kind of time to prepare and contemplate and heal relationships like they may have in a hospice setting, or may not have, depending on the, you know, the situation of the patient and family. But I think that's where compassion becomes a source of hope, that as people are navigating terrible atrocities and tragedies and, you know, things that are unjust and shouldn't happen in the world, those of us who live out of a place of hope can extend compassion and care and try to live, you know, in a way that's just and make our communities better and address injustice where we see it, and that can be a source of hope. That we can't always prevent suffering, and we can't prevent things from happening that happen suddenly and tragically, but we can be there as a community to support people and to be a source of hope and care and compassion so that people are not left alone.
That's Jamie Beachy. She's a manager for spiritual care and education at Boulder Community Health. My other guest this morning is Marcia Latanzi-Licht, who's co-founder of Boulder County Hospice, now True Community Care. She's also a psychotherapist and educator and author. And my co-host this morning, as always, on this series that we do on end-of-life issues, Kim Mooney. And I don't want to dwell too much on the awful things that can happen to people. But Marcia, I know that you've been a panelist on there was a major hospice teleconference, coping with public tragedy. Of course, Colorado's had to deal with that too many times. Right now, of course, we have a very public trial going on for a very public tragedy, the Aurora Theater shooting. How do you have hope in those kind of cases?
Well, I would just link up with what we've been talking about so far. It the more a loss is acknowledged and recognized and the more people are supportive, it is a counterpoint to the tragedy. And so I think it's really important, and the connection with meaning is critical. So I think it's really important that people try to find their way to seeing what is good in life, not just what is terrible. The difficult thing about trials and public proceedings like we're having now is that they often give us an illusion that there is justice. And justice is not a tangible, specific reality. It is influenced by laws and public and private interests. And so if you think that you'll find peace after something like that, it is an illusion. It is more or less something that might give resolution to what happened or the perpetrator, but it is not ever where you find your peace. That is an internal thing. And so community and individual support and the search for meaning, all the good things that have been done after big tragedies matter. So think of MAD and all that they've done in the aftermath of drunk driving deaths.
Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
Right. And think about all the efforts now families are making toward gun control, or, you know, certain things that we try to do to right wrongs that have been or make our society a better place to live in. That gives people a sense of meaning. Some people find it on an individual level, just being supportive of others who've had similar experiences. But that allows us to continue on in a world that in one view seems terribly hostile and dangerous, and in the other view can be sustaining, and there are good people who will stand by you in those times. So
we're talking about hope on Community Radio KGNU this morning in the context of end of life as part of our quarterly series on end of life issues, practically dying. And this morning, obviously, our focus has been on, you know, the spiritual, emotional aspect of hope, but it really has a physical manifestation as well. And Kimuni, I know for your years and years of experience in hospice care, working with end of life patients themselves and also the people, I mean, what is the physicality around when you have a lack of hope? Because I know when you have, you know, spiritual or even existential pain, that can manifest itself physically. Mm-hmm. And a lack of hope can really impact medical outcomes as well.
Yeah, it's similar to depression in that sense, that it can change your biochemistry, it can change your outlook. It tends to interact with your energy. So people who are depressed or hopeless don't exercise as much. So it's a kind of a vicious circle. But partly what we've been talking about also is, as we've said, it's not a passive thing. So hope is sort of, it's been described as a combination of attitude and action. So when people actually can look at something and find meaning in it, or quit doing the things that are preventing them from feeling hopeful, it tends to move people into action. As Marcia talked about Mothers Against Drunk Driving, Frankl talked about being in the concentration camps and saying that to provide hope for those people, they would sit around and talk about recipes. And what it did was it reminded them of good times and sharing things, but it also gave them, even though they couldn't physically move with it, it gave them that sense that they were going to be able to do something again. So in the same way that an athlete can, you know, project a tennis shot and then be able to make it because they focused on it, sometimes the idea of thinking positively allows you to move into that. And that movement is important to hope. It's not passive.
Now, that whole idea of positive thinking when it comes to medicine, there have been criticism of this. I want to think back to Barbara Ehrenreich, the author. We talked to her several years ago when she had gone through, I'm not sure if she had gone through cancer or she had just talked to people who'd gone through cancer. And she talked about how often with women, when they're going through something very serious, like, say, breast cancer, that there's a very much an attitude, you know, why don't you keep a journal and you have to be positive and da-da-da-da-da. If you compare that to how men are treated in a medical situation, it's very much, we're going to get this. It's, you know, it's away from the touchy-feely thing. And she's quite critical of that. It's like, why are we being kind of, told to sit in the corner and think about pretty things when we need, you know, action? And so I know that there's maybe a fine line, certainly when it comes to medicine and when people are told to, you must have hope, you must think positive because that's the way to get through.
You know, I think that we tend to, particularly in Boulder County, to do the to focus on the positive thinking. And the sin of that actually is that then people who do get sick or do die feel like they failed. I think it's like anything else, it's really across the board. You need a balance of those things, and maybe at different times, you know, go to an allopathic doctor to find out if you broke your leg. And if you didn't, then you can meditate and you can do some energy work on it. So it's neither one or the other. And that's true with almost all esoteric topics, I think.
But Jamie Beach, you wanted to add to that.
Sure. I also think that there's a paradox that might be a more helpful way of thinking about hope in relationship to loss, or it's helpful for me anyway in my work and with the patients that I've accompanied through loss, that descending into grief actually creates space for hope and creates the opportunity to feel supported and to feel in tune and integrated in your experience. And if we keep people from the opportunity to experience grief, and we try to to hold permission for that, then people end up suffering more mm-hmm. than they would if they're just held and able to experience their loss authentically.
Now, all of you come from... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Marcia.
I wanted to say just something about, in general, our culture loves to try to shore people up and cheer them along. And that's a good thing if it's in balance with other things, with the allowing people the experience. I think it makes us generally so uncomfortable when people are struggling that we tend to avoid it. And so one of the things that I think all of us are called upon is to try to enter into moments when people are having great difficulty in spite of how difficult it is, because the whole thing that's necessary in hope in general is to transcend, to rise above, and you can't rise above until you've experienced what's there. Mm-hmm. So you're absolutely right. You have mm-hmm. to enter into the experience, and then you can look at it from a different perspective if you are with people around you who care about you.
That's Marcia Latanzi-Licht, who has a long background in hospice care. She's a co-founder of Boulder County Hospice, now True Community Care. She's a psychotherapist and educator and author, speaks globally on end-of-life issues and hospice issues. Our other guest is Jamie Beachy, who's manager for spiritual care and education at Boulder Community Health. And my co-host, Kim Mooney, with practicallydying.com, is that mm-hmm. the website? A long career in hospice care, and she... joins me on a quarterly basis to talk about these end-of-life issues here at KGNU. If you have a question or comment and would like to join the conversation, we're talking about hope, what that means in end-of-life here at KGNU. The number is 303-442-4242. 303-442-4242. Kim.
So first, it's practically-dying.com. I forget that too. Some of the words that we've used here in the last couple of minutes have been really important. Perspective, I think, is one that if you are not allowed to drop into your personal experience, there's no way for you to get the right perspective to decide what it is to hope for. And sometimes it's just hoping to be supported in the middle of that. But one of the things I think we see at the work, I'm going to call it the end of life, but the truth being that we're dying all the time, and that any moment that we let go of something, we have to hope for what's next, and particularly in the hospital, even though people may not have a terminal diagnosis, as soon as they walk in and their health has changed, there is a serious death of the future, death of assumptive world. So I think one of the ways we can pick this apart is to help people understand that there's a difference between giving up hope and giving up a hope.
So, okay, break that down for me.
Well, you may be very seriously ill and you have to let go of the hope that you'll always be very healthy. But that doesn't mean that the concept of hope or the more sophisticated aspects of hope or the gift of hope should be gotten rid of or let go of.
So I suppose this ties into what we were talking about earlier, that you can have hope even in the light of dying and even in the light of a terminal illness. It's not the fact that it's what type of hope that you have, Marcia.
Exactly. So hope is the constant. Hope is the thread throughout our lives. What we hope for mm-hmm. changes. And that's true in aging as well as in loss or other circumstances. As we grow older, we may no longer be able to hike a 14er, but could we take a leisurely, lovely walk or stroll somewhere that matters to mm-hmm. us? So I think it's the constant in our life. And it is, remember, it's one of the three sisters. It's associated with love or charity and faith as well. So they are really related to each other and connected in many ways, which is why I think this whole theme around caring is so important. The support of others matters a great deal.
And also, go ahead, Jamie.
I also think that there's a long tradition of protest and lament. So for some people, affirming life means protesting death up until the very end. And and just lamenting the loss of life. And that's also a form of hope, mm-hmm. you know, that not everyone needs to die peacefully or die assenting to, you know, to the experience, that there's a strong tradition in the spiritual and religious and cultural traditions that affirms that, you know, protesting death is also a form of hope and affirmation of life.
We're talking about hope at the end of life here at Community Radio KGNU Boulder, Denver. The number to call is 303-442-4242 if you'd like to join the conversation. We do have calls coming in. We'll start with Jim in Boulder. Welcome to the show. What's your question or comment?
I just wanted one of the panelists to address, we talked about attitude and hopefully then leading to action. To find what we, I guess, this illusory hope. If my real question is hope that a parent, you know, when a parent dies, is a different kind of effect on the individual as, say, a spouse, as than a tangential relationship, say, a friend. I've been there. I know what it's like to lose a child. And a child, to me, was hope for the future. Mm-hmm. So when a child dies, then, you know, I've found that the future is affected. And how does one then draw on all these ideas of thinking about the making recipes, as Frankl alludes, when the very future, you know, with that individual has been taken away?
I'd like to respond to that as a parent who's lost a child, too. I have the absolute understanding that the future you wanted and the future you tried to create in your life is taken away from you. And I think that does mean you have to rework the whole framework of your life. And I think there were two things that struck me in my journey. One is how I wanted to be in the world. I wanted to still be a proud and good mother to my son, and who was still living, and I wanted to make sure that I could have some engagement with life. So I think one of the most important things that we look to after a horrendous loss is how can we still be connected with life and with other people, and can we make some sort of contribution that will be a reason to live. Those are reasons to go on. And I often think in my life that I want my daughter Ellen to always, and however and wherever she is, to be proud of me. So that's another way of looking at things. Just how do we choose to live our lives in spite of what has happened?
I also want to remind people what Jamie said is that it doesn't mean that something's going to happen and you're going to hop to hope. That moving into that grief is often a feeling like despair, that really, until you're really down in it, you don't understand that there's a point at which you don't understand how the world can change or how you can change. And that's what also needs to be cherished. And when we start to break down all these hopes, that is the hope for permission and support to be wherever you are.
Jim?
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Please do, Jim. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, let's assume that before this event happens, that one's attitude, and we can see it borders on depression. How does one deal then with the double whammy? That, you know, you can have this hopeful person before the death of whether it's parent, child, or spouse, or friend, or tragedies that happen daily. I only think of pre-existing conditions that make one more prone to maybe not seeing hope. Maybe it was a length of period of time that the parent and child suffered together as compared to an unexpected death, which, you know, doesn't really play on the idea of what was one's attitude before the event. How does that play out? And can that play out in a lot different in a lot of different fashion based on who that and the makeup of the personality of the person that's left behind in the grieving process of what they were like before this event.
Oh, I was sorry, Marcia, and I have lots of ideas about this. I appreciate your sharing your experience, and I think that the loss of a child is a devastating loss in many ways, and one that, you know, where depression is a natural response, and one that I hope you've had support for and found a community to grieve with. I do think that, you know, that just living life requires quite a tremendous amount of resiliency. And so the losses that we all face as we navigate life, you know, will bring the resources that we have to the loss. And so one of the gifts of being around death and dying and being with people who are experiencing loss is the reminder that, you know, spiritual practice and that preparing for loss and change is a big part of what it means to live well. And that, you know, the ways that we're frail and in need of support from others and maybe in need of resources beyond ourselves, professional resources, becomes really clear when we experience loss. And I hope that you feel that you're in good company in this conversation because, you know, none of us are completely prepared for what we experience in life, and there's a lot of help out there that I hope you're able to access.
I'd add a couple things to that. One is, you're right, Jim, the whatever we bring to the situation of our losses is the backdrop of the picture and colors the experience. And part of depression is self-criticism. However, all of us who have had depression in our lives know that we develop capacities to deal with it. And hope is about a capacity within us for dignity and survival and continuing on in spite of great difficulties. So I think the more we are able to deal with other contingencies of our life, the better we are able to deal with grief. And hope is always about some measure of well-being. I think you're right. In grief, if we talk about hope with parents or survivors of suicide or, you know, any major loss, it sounds like an illusion in some ways. And I think we do need to recognize that we're not talking about an illusion of hope or a Pollyannish vision of hope. We're talking about an internal sustaining element that can make a difference in our well-being.
Well, Jim, I really appreciate you calling in. Our sincere condolences to you. I think, as Kim Mooney has said, there's a special type of grief that is only experienced by parents who lose a child. Do you feel hopeful, just as we let you go? Do you feel hopeful?
No, but, you know, the thing is, and I guess the last thing I just say is that everybody grieves, and the time that it takes to work through that, whether even you have the spiritual practice or the support or seeking a professional, I just would add is so dependent or so different for each individual. I think that you can't just say that there's a magic time that the grieving ends or, you know, mm-hmm. It doesn't consume you. It does get, you know, you do learn to live with it, but I don't know if you do learn to overcome it.
Well, Jim, we wish you the best. Thank you for calling
Thank
in.
You. Okay.
It's 9:05 here at KGNU Boulder, Denver. We're talking about hope and end-of-life issues as part of our quarterly series, Practically Dying. My co-host Kim Mooney joining me, along with guest Jamie Beachy, who's Manager for Spiritual Care and Education at Boulder Community Health, and Marcia Latanzi-Licht, who's co-founder of Boulder County Hospice, now True Community Care, who's a psychotherapist, an educator, and an author. We'd like to go back to the phones. Deborah in Denver, thanks for holding. Welcome to the show. What's your question or comment?
First of all, thanks very much for holding. This is a great conversation. I think that there's two things. One is that we're always losing hope or, dreams don't work out. Projects don't work out. Our hopes don't work. You know, whatever plans we have don't work out. And we're always grieving the loss of some plans or some wish, like relationships end or whatever. So it's a continual process, and I wish that we had more hospice or grieving support groups for people, for adults children too, to grieve the loss of their plans or their dreams that don't work out. And some people get skilled and have more resiliency and so forth, but I wish there were more available grief support groups, because it's a continual thing. And a lot of times, like a public death is supported better than these little private losses that people suffer, like poor people who continually are barraged with loss. But anyway, the second thing is, I had to help a friend who was dying recently, and I was really upset because she, I thought, hadn't gotten help for herself early enough. You know, she just believed in alternative medicine so much she wouldn't go to allopathic doctors. It really upset me, and I had all these judgments, because so now she's really dying. But I went to a movie recently, which I'd like to share, which was really helpful for me. It was called Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. It's a movie at theaters around town now. And it really helped me, because it's a teenager who has to help it. Are you there?
We're here, Deborah. Please go ahead.
It's a teenager who has to help. His mother tells him he has to go visit a girl who's dying of leukemia, and he doesn't want to go, but he goes, and he stays present with her. I mean, he becomes friends with her. And it really, that movie helped me go visit this friend who I had such mixed feelings and judgments about. And it really helped me be present with her. I just recommend this movie. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Deborah. I appreciate that. And that actually reminds me of, I think something Deborah was saying, that we don't have enough forms, public forms, for people to grieve in. And often when we have, it could be a movie or it could be a major national tragedy or somebody well known dies, that we can often experience grief in an accepted public way, mm-hmm. that we don't. I mean, I often say I didn't cry at my mother's funeral. I was in shock. But if I'd go to that movie, I'd be in tears for the whole 3 hours, because I would probably experience my own grieving. You know, Marcia, right. Or Jamie, mm-hmm. do you want to talk about that?
I think because it's one step removed, it's a little safer sometimes, and it triggers our memories, our responses, our losses. And that's not a bad thing. It's what you do with it in the aftermath. I think when things rise up, we should look at them, and then we can put them back in place. I think the whole notion of who we share our sorrows with is an important one. Not everyone is willing, and not everyone is able. We used to talk more in times past at kitchen tables or in living rooms, and we'd talk, and family members would say or not say, but they would be together in those experiences. And I wonder how Cross Time will play this out with our age of technology now. There are many support forums that are online, and so we're just learning different ways we'll be supportive of each other, since we don't have as close physical connections with each other as we might have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm also aware of the need for public memorials, mm-hmm. so places where people can gather and return to revisit loss, that we have a lack of, in general, in I think in the U.S., public places where people can come and grieve. I know the Vietnam War Memorial is a powerful place for many, many veterans and their families to return and to revisit that loss and tragedy and that time in history. And it provides a place for, you know, people to grieve and to remember and to continue to revisit and remember, that it's not just something that you do once and then you move on and you've completed your developmental task and then you're all done. But as Deborah made clear, there are many losses throughout life, and to teach children how to remember and to grieve well and to move on makes for a much healthier community.
We're talking about hope here at KGNU. We've got just under 20 minutes left. It's part of our quarterly series on end-of-life issues, Practically Dying. My co-host Kim Mooney, practically-dying.com. You can find it more. A long, long background of experience working in hospice care, as does Marcia Latanzi-Licht. She, in fact, co-founded Boulder County Hospice, which is now True Community Care. She's a psychotherapist, an educator, and an author. And Jamie Beachy joins us. She's manager for spiritual care and education at Boulder Community Health. If you'd like to join the conversation, maybe share your own story and perspective on hope, how that pertains to end-of-life issues, 303-442-4242, 303-442-4242. Now, all three of you really have a background in clinical care as well, because hospice care is more than just spiritual and emotional support. It's clinical and therapeutic support, you know, when you look at palliative care. And then, of course, Jamie, you work in a hospital setting as well. What about this idea in a clinical sense with doctors? Because it seems that hope in that sense is only if there's a cure or if we're going to make you better. I mean, is that kind of a narrative that's pretty dominant in traditional medical care, not obviously hospice care?
Right. I think it has to do with our expectations, that we, in a medical model that is more paternal, we look to providers of care to give us not just care, but hope and understanding. And so to shift that away from something that may not be able to be cured or fixed in any particular way means we have to reframe it. And, you know, the one thing that always gives us hope is the nature of a relationship. Relationships foster hope. And so if physicians have a capacity to engage and see the person they're working with, that person has some measure of hope that they can deal with this, perhaps. It's a different kind of hope, but it still gives you hope. Maybe not for a cure, but a different sense of hope. So relationships and communication foster hope. It's a matter of dignity and respect that I think then helps us feel able to handle what is happening.
And then there are also just best practices in medical interventions that can create the opportunity for hope so that people feel that their medical care continues throughout the continuum of their lifespan, you know, so that when we're transitioning people into palliative care, their pain is being well addressed, their symptoms are well managed, that they get to decide what their goals for care are, and that the medical expertise is just as sophisticated at that point as it is when you go into a surgery or you're receiving a more, traditional intervention, so that we still have a ways to go with the way that we conceive of care as continuing across the lifespan of a person. We still have this idea of a shift, that somehow care should shift from intervention to palliative. But I envision a time in the future where we don't have to envision a shift. We just experience care across the continuum, you know, from birth to death. And that expertise is available, medical expertise, and the best that Western medicine and complementary, you know, integrative medicine can provide will be available to people at each point in the lifespan.
And does that need to then happen at a medical school setting? We've talked about before that end-of-life and hospice care doctors, I mean, it's a very different attitude from an emergency room doctor or a surgeon who wants to get in and fix you and cure you. I mean, in many ways, it's a completely different attitude towards care. I mean, Kim Mooney, do hospice care doctors have very specific training, or is it just something in their own personality, their own philosophy that makes them want to get into hospice care? Because it is such a different field of medicine.
I think there's a continuum there. There is a certification. There's a track that's really important and becoming more important in palliative and hospice medicine. But I do think that people choose by disposition the kind of things that they want to do, or in their practice, they all of a sudden realize that this is happening. And they see patients with different needs, and they are drawn toward that more present kind of medicine. There is a lot of education going on outside of medical schools, although I do think we're trying to get people earlier. And it's a shift in their not only responsibility, but their shift in their role in life and how they see themselves as healers. Doesn't mean that they're not healing, but they still need to see themselves as healers. The education that I've been doing with doctors in the community, what I find is interesting is we always assume that they're egotistical or that they, they don't want to do this. They don't want to give up cure. And truly, there is a lot of fear because they've been trained in a certain arena that if they can't perform there with all the expectations, that they have failed. But what I found is a lot of them need help with language. They don't know how to say the things that they think are going to be supportive, and they don't know what is going to be supportive because, as we see in some of the literature, there's a difference between false hope, you're going to get better, and false hopelessness, which is there's nothing more we can do. So I find a lot of people are much more open to being trained to know how to interact, to have that relationship. Mm-hmm. That's a more significant point than whether they fall on the which side of the table they
fall. And then to also be able to do their own inner work and to not turn away from their own grief and loss with the experiences they have as mm-hmm. clinicians. So it's there's a lot of burden involved with being a physician, decisions that you have to make that are really heartbreaking sometimes, and you don't know if you're making the right decision with a person who's vulnerable. And, you know, sometimes there are errors that happen or things that poor outcomes that weren't anticipated. And so the burden of being a professional caregiver, a provider, especially for the physicians, is significant. And to help, you know, there's a lot of work being done with Rachel Naomi Remen is a great example of looking at meaning in medicine and helping physicians early on in their medical school training really have the tools that they need to navigate their own sense of meaning and purpose in their work so that they're doing the work with themselves that they can then invite patients and families into participating in, because mm-hmm. we can't really offer what we don't do for ourselves to
That's
know,
Jamie
others.
Beachy with Boulder mm-hmm. Community Health. Marcia Latanzi-Licht, you wanted to weigh in?
Well, I think it's really important to recognize that physicians are typically extraordinarily well-intentioned and committed, and it is a question of languaging things, and it's also the art of stepping back a little and asking good questions so that you become more the background and the person you're working with is more in the foreground, where the focus is on what's important to them, what matters to them, so that they have some element of choice. Again, choices help us feel a measure of hope, so mm-hmm. I think that's the most powerful thing, not to feel that I have to have the solution. I can give you the benefit of my knowledge and expertise. What matters to you now? How do you see yourself in this? One of my clients recently talked about, and one of the challenges of growing older is, as the Brits would say, having been made redundant, as if you're superfluous in life and you don't matter as much anymore. Well, people with illness feel that. And so the flip side of the coin she was talking about is a search to feel that she mattered, to feel relevant. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's really important. When people have illness, we might not see them as able to make good choices that fit for who they are as human beings. So that's one of the arts of medicine, nursing. Most of the research, by the way, on hope has been done in the nursing realm. And so it's a question of how we approach people and see them as capable of making good choices for mm-hmm. their lives.
Mm-hmm. We just have about 10 minutes left in our show this morning, talking about hope in the end of life as part of our quarterly series on end of life issues, practically dying. Marcia Latanzi-Licht, earlier one of our callers, Jim, called in and said he'd lost a child, and at the end he said he didn't have hope. You've been in the same situation. How did you get your hope back?
Well, we talked before about how we see things, how we think about things. It would be a lie to say I had hope throughout this process. On the other hand, were there elements of hope? Yes. And I think what gave me hope most was all the work I had done in the years with hospice with bereaved parents, who I knew were inordinately fine people, loving, generous people, and that if they got through it, maybe I could too. So one of the things we know in life is that we learn with models, and people who are good models help us a great deal. So I often think about that with people I know, that I want to be the kind of person that might help people reclaim some hope in their lives. Hope comes and it goes, and there are some days where it's awfully hard to find it. But on the other hand, if we look, and if we especially look in the relationship realm or in the realm of what is possible, then I think hope is there. We just have to reclaim it, and it's a different hope than we expected. I'll tell you a little story. When we were in the emergency room after my daughter's death, I said to a friend who was standing nearby, "So who am I going to sit on the porch to and talk to? And I'm an old lady," thinking my daughter would definitely be that person or one of those people. And my friend said, "Well, you'll be talking with all the rest of us who are your friends and old people." And what a wise thing, because what he said was, "You're not going to be alone." And that is, I think, what gives us hope, the fact that we will not be alone. So people who just, the metaphor of hospice, "I will journey with you," people who will stand by us and just be with us, makes a huge difference.
So what advice can you give to folks like Jim, who feel they don't have hope, or, you know, any of our listeners who maybe feel in that position. Deborah brought up the idea of having more support groups. I mean, because, of course, there's loss at every part of life, and it's not always, a, you know, a death. Jamie?
Well, one thing I would encourage us to rethink as a community is looking at hope as an individual responsibility. You know, that I'm responsible for maintaining my own sense of hope, and that if I lose that, it's gone and it's lost, and I have to work to reclaim that and regain it somehow through my own hard work. And in Marcia sharing and Jim's story as well, I see how hope can sometimes be held by those around you. You know, as chaplains in the hospital, sometimes we see ourselves as holding hope for the other person when they're not able to access it themselves, and that hope really lives in a community. It doesn't just live in an individual. And so, as we're doing now, we're exploring hope as a group here, and we're holding it together. So it doesn't have to be something that, you know, the individual possesses and it's gone and then you have to feel guilty that you don't have it. You know, you can rely on your family and friends and your community and professionals who can hold it for you until you find your way back to it, and then you can take that responsibility eventually for others who lose their sense of hope. And that's what I think it can mean to be a community of care.
Well, we just have about 5 minutes left. We could probably squeeze in one more call, but I'd like to bring up the idea of hope and how people maintain hope, not if they're in hospice care or have had a terminal illness, but say if they're on a longer journey and maybe have a degenerative disease. I mean, we've done some stories on assisted suicide bills and various different things. People who are not going to die anytime soon, but they really want to hasten that process. And I know this is going to be subject of an upcoming show we're going to have, Kim. How do people maintain hope like that when they themselves want to die? I mean, is there hope even in that process? Mm-hmm.
I think it's about that issue we talked about earlier, and that is how we maintain some measure of control, choice, self-determination. It's such a one of the most painful things in life to have a long-term chronic degenerative disease, because you not only have to deal with it in the moment, you look down the road and you have to deal with it every day from here on in. So having some measure of being able to shape how that would look for you in the future and to feel loved still and attended to still. People's greatest fear, we have a huge body of research, people's greatest fear is abandonment, mm-hmm. And to be left alone. So again, those are common human themes that come up, and Jamie's absolutely right. If we have people around us caring for us, then it can make the difference in seeing us through that journey.
Mm-hmm. I also think we keep struggling with the word control, that part of what it is it's being able to participate in things. It's not a matter of controlling them. So, you know, we've also talked about the fact that can you make a difference in the situation? Can you actively make a difference, whether it's one small thing? So often dealing with people who have no hope or feel like they don't have any, it's what's the next small thing? And that's one of the reasons that support groups and grief support groups are valuable throughout your life, is that when you can move at all, and for many periods of time you can't, there are people around you who can maybe show you one thing that they've done, or just be an example of one thing that they've done. It's not a matter of bursting into a huge cloud of hope or changing. What's the next thing I can do tomorrow that's going to move me forward a little bit? And that's where that action comes in.
Well, just as we finish up, I would like to give listeners maybe some resources where they can either access support groups or find out more. I know there are a lot of them out there, so maybe the internet is probably the best place. Or Kim, do you have any suggestions?
I think it's a good place to start, simply because there's such a broad range of things. I want to say one more thing in regard to loss of a child and clinical depression that you had before, is that we often say when someone's going through a big loss, not to leap to medication. And this is some place where we see physicians and psychiatrists go to help mask it or relieve the symptoms or whatever they want to, whatever they're leaning toward. But so in general, that may get in the way of someone moving through something. But if you have clinical depression, if you've had a pre-existing condition, I think it's really important to address that, again, allopathically, so that we're looking at all of the assets that we have. It's not that you just need to drop into your grief. You really need to deal with it, you know, holistically.
Yeah, and I would say there are a lot of resources in Boulder, in the Boulder community especially, that encourage spiritual practice and practices that can support moving through loss in a healthy way, so that, you know, meditation practices, there are yoga studios on just about every block in the Boulder community, and places to go where you can join other people who are practicing resiliency and open-heartedness and, you know, the kinds of resources that we all need to move through life well. And that even if you don't have a strong community, and many college students we're aware at the hospital come to Boulder community and may be isolated and may not feel like they have a strong sense of community, but that the natural world and, you know, just getting out into the natural world in Boulder is a great resource, too, to feel supported there by the sun and the trees and the water, and to, you know, to identify a practice that can help build that kind of resiliency and kind of build your muscles for navigating loss and change is important.
Marcia.
There are many groups in town. Rocky Mountain Cancer Center has support groups. True has support groups. There are many online. Many, many groups are available to people. I think you're right. The internet is a place to start, Kim. But I would also say look within your world. Look within the natural group of activities that you have, mm-hmm. because there are some people who really are members of a faith community, and that is where they find their strength and sustaining elements. And I do like what you said earlier, Kim, about the whole sense that hope is not always in the immediate moment. Hope may be on the horizon. So Shakespeare talks about the tender leaves of hope, mm-hmm. tomorrow's blossoms. It might not always be for today, but a vision mm-hmm. of what might be tomorrow or another point in the road.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to thank all our guests this morning. Marcia Latanzi-Licht, who was the co-founder of Boulder Community Hospice, now True Community Care. She's a psychotherapist, an educator, and an author. We're linking to her website at kgnu.org. Jamie Beachy is manager for spiritual care and education at Boulder Community Health. And as always, my co-host Kim Mooney, a longtime worker in hospice care, practically dying.com. We're linking to that at kgnu.org as well. And Kim, as I said, the next show we're going to talk about that very difficult topic where, you know, personal choice when mm-hmm. to end your life. That's coming up on October 28th, The Value of Life.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so that'll be a discussion. Please do tune in for that. And of course, you can listen to all of our archived shows on end of life issues. Go to our website, news.kgnu.org. Thank you all very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.